and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hey everyone, I'm Mark Marble.
And I'm Chad Buckelman.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 623.
Green Lantern 28.
Yeah. Let's dive in. Look, you know what? It's better than Absolute 7.
You ruined the surprise, Chad. By default, blank pages would have been better than Absolute number 7. Legacy number 595, which makes you wonder if issue 33, if something important going to happen in 33, since it would be Legacy 600.
It's crazy that our numbering is higher than the legacy numbering of the publication history of Green Lantern. We know this number is a little off.
Yeah, all these legacy numbers can, because it's like, well, how exact? Brief tangent, yes. If you're legitimately not counting minis, you're not counting annuals, you're just counting, and again, anything, and if you were just counting titles with that name, which is dicey, because we know Morrison's book was the Green Lantern, so it becomes a slippery slope even there. But if you just said every Green Lantern monthly book, and that becomes dicey too. But it's still, yeah, there's too many intangibles to really know, which is why you don't friggin' restart a book every 2 years. Spoiler alert. So, yeah, so we will be doing the epilogue to the Starbreaker Supremacy, which is, as Chad kind of alluded to briefly in his own way, is actually better than the Starbreaker Supremacy. For the most part, it is. All right, so we begin in the wreckage of the power battery at the Castle of the Desolate Stone. Now, I must admit, considering they have a one-track mind here, I thought it would... In retrospect, it would be funny if we saw, like, Nate's corpse or, like, his arm sticking out of the rubble, because nobody would clearly give a shit because they're only looking for one thing. But, and the one thing that they're looking for, and we'll come back to Joe and her witty dialogue in this page, but they're looking for the Book of Oa, which is good because that's kind of something you don't want to let slip by, even though they have no real checks and balances and quality control over keeping it safe, apparently. But when they do find the book... And, of course, Joe has to be the one that finds it. But they find the book, and Guy is looking at it, and he's all excited because of the fact that apparently Starbreaker has been translating and able to translate some of the dual or multi-layers on these pages, as we found out that there were different messages written in, related to the emotional spectrum on every page. And Guy stumbles upon a page, and it's like, oh, that really shouldn't be there. And, of course, the page just has, like, Green Lantern symbol, and it has Hal Jordan in crazy, like a crazy and Guardian-like font written in the Book of Oa. So this issue is, kind of appropriately, the name, Jeremy Adams, V. Ken Marion, Romulo Fajardo Jr., the colorist, Dave Sharp, letterer, cover artist, Zomanico, variant cover artist. Yeah, we usually don't do those. But there's Rock DeLynn, David Parator, and what is that, Duali? That's what it looks like. I'm trying to zoom in.
I'm not good at the names.
Yeah, but it's like a comma, so it's just a one thing. It's like Duali. It's not even a hyphen, I don't think. So Gillian Grant and Paul Kaminsky, editor, which we'll come back to this too, because there's some self-serving stuff in this issue. Must be quid pro quo time in the Jeremy Adams book. So now that we see Hal's name, we cut to Coast City, where Hal's apprehending, like, this dog creature who was planning on terraforming Coast City to get an element that he needed or whatever. And Hal's like really putting this guy literally through the ringer. He's like flying him through, giving him a tour of Coast City and making him sick in the process and just scaring the living hell out of this guy. A little mean, but probably well deserved. And after Hal does this little tour of duty and he's getting ready to take this guy to Oa, that's when Hal gets notified that, hey, you need to come to Oa because we need you to something you have to see. So he makes like a Grand Prix Green Lantern car, throws this alien in the back who's already like more than enough of Hal Jordan's hijinks, and now he's going to have to do the whole tour of the Milky Way as Hal's taking him back to Oa. We have it's kind of a stupid scene, in my opinion, that you have Kyle and Odyssey and Connor. Why these other two are still hanging around, no real logic anymore. They served a purpose in the Stormbreaker Supremacy, why they were here in a particular mission, why they're still hanging around, there's no real logic to it at this point. But Kyle, apparently, they even though it was Connor's idea, they decide they want to see Kyle, because it seems Kyle is a White Lantern, can only be white, he can, now it's like all over the map. It seems like Kyle can channel a White Lantern when he wants to, but he can't hold on to the power very long when he lets it go. So they're trying to see like how long it takes for him to recharge. And so Connor gets blasted, and that's right, you know, Hal drops this guy off, you know, I guess at the science cells, and that's when he sees Connor getting blasted. Hal goes, picks him up, he flies him back down to where Kyle is, and they kind of give Hal, you know, they kind of give Hal the primer on what's going on. And Hal's kind of easygoing about this, which I kind of thought it was weird that Kyle is so quick to say, aren't you supposed to be on Earth? That kind of seemed like a little rude to me. Because Kyle's just randomly talking about stuff related to him and the Flash. And, oh, yeah, we did something similar, so it's all fun. It's like all fun and games. It seemed odd. Hal gets summoned. He goes to see one of the Guardians, who I like the fact that this Guardian, the yellow lantern-wearing symbol Guardian, is a Templar Guardian. That's who he looks like. He and Jessica are waiting for Hal. They take Hal to the Book of Oa to show him this page. I do like the Doc Ock look by Guy. That's a nice touch when he's literally going over the Book of Oa with a fine-tooth comb. Hal looks at the page, and he's stunned. He kind of stunned to see his name, and all of a sudden he like screams in pain. He blacks out because there was some kind of connection with the Book of Oa, and you know Hal is unconscious. Jessica and Guy are taking him to the med bay. The Guardian is kind of like, oh, this is not good. It's like Hal Jordan knows. And the other Guardians are like, what does Hal Jordan know? And it's like, well, something about essentially what happened to them with Krona, how we got some knowledge via Krona. I think the same thing kind of happened to Hal Jordan when he looked at the book. And, you know, that same yellow Guardian, it's like, well, we need to do what we should have done in the first place. Because ever since we came out of the Source Lantern, we've really been missing so much of who we really are. We've gotten a little bit more knowledge now, Krona's knowledge, but we still are missing a whole crap ton of information, a buttload, if you will. So they're going to leave Oa because they feel, or he fears in particular, I like that because of the fact that he's yellow, so he's talking about fear, that they don't figure out exactly what the knowledge is, that they... Basically, if they don't know what they don't know at the moment, that pretty much everything they've built and everything they've created is probably going to be destroyed. Hal comes to and he kind of just shakes it off. Jessica is a little more concerned than that. Even Guy's a little bit more concerned. So she sends him back to Earth to just base almost. It's not quite being on leave, but it's similar. It's like, yeah, go spend some time with Carol, relax, and if something comes up, we'll let you know. Now we cut to one of the more interesting parts to the book. Wherever the hell they are, the mutated Hal Jordan clone that Krona inhabits talks about. He senses that the Guardians are on the move, and whether it's convenience or not, he understands that the Guardians have picked up some of his knowledge when his gestation went awry. And he's saying that there's a piece of their origin. There's basically all the Guardians' origin that's still missing somehow. And that's a piece that Krona is going to basically claim for himself. Now, during this conversation, kind of like being prophetic, since we just talked about this last issue and Anas and I were just talking about it, yes, as expected, that the entities are not dead. The entities are like all in little test tubes, kind of like being regrown, because it looks like they all, I mean, they look like they're much smaller versions of the entities we know, but they're connected like via umbilical cords and things like that. So we assume Krona is in the process of healing the entities and or potentially siphoning off some more power, but probably both, but he has plans for them. But so it's safe to say all the entities, unfortunately, it looks like even Parallax Jr., Timu Parallax, are still alive. Hal arrives at the Justice League Watchtower to go spend some time with Carol. He and Carol touch, and at that moment, Hal gets this vision. He gets this vision, which we'll talk about too. It appears on the surface that the Guardians are fighting Hal Jordan. We see like seven stars in the sky, which we assume relate to the emotional spectrum. We see this castle, which at least Chad and I have no idea what this is. If it's something we should know, we didn't recognize it. There's a cloaked figure looking up at it, which may or not be Krona, because Krona's wearing some funky armor. It probably isn't Krona, but we see Krona in the mutated Hal Jordan body wearing some kind of armor. But by the way, Krona did mention that supposedly, anyway, until it gets changed, this body of his is permanently damaged, so he can't. So it doesn't look like he can heal this body, this clone version of Hal Jordan that he wanted, which he did want, by the way, to destroy the core from within. So I'm kind of patting myself on the back for kind of getting that one right too. Hal's kind of recovers, shakes it off, tries to make it sound like it's no big deal, and there's a problem in Star City. Starfire is notified of it, and Hal says, I'll take care of it, and then it'll just come back. And it's like, well, we know what's going to happen when you go to Star City. You and Ollie, you're going to hang out. And it's like, well, just go have fun, and I'll talk to you when you get back. And Carol's still worried about him going in. Maybe when you get back, you'll let me know what's going on. And next issue, Hard Traveling Heroes.
Touching on the Krona thing real quick, I like that at least it seems like we're going to stick with the idea that the body is mutated and cannot be fixed or changed. Because if we didn't, then we just almost get another shapeshifter-esque story. You know, somebody who's not really who they're supposed to be type of a thing. So that's nice that, you know, we're going to stick with that. Although, I allow for the possibility that that could change, you know, whether because seems as if he's siphoning off the power, or giving the power to the entities to accomplish his needs. We don't know which way this power is going. You know, last time we saw Krona, he had wrapped him, or at least I guess our universe's Krona, he had wrapped himself in those
Malthusian bandages.
Yeah, those bandages. So maybe those could play a part of healing or evolving the body in some way, shape, or form. I don't know.
He could grow he could grow another one.
Yeah, so, like, we don't know, but I do like we're not going to have to, at least for a little bit, it seems like, deal with the whole, you know, somebody pretending to be somebody they're not again in this series. So that's cool to see. The entities here, it's unclear, like, if he's siphoning off of them and that explains their dilapidated tiny state, or if he's restoring them, given everything that happened during the Starbreaker, like, you know, they were diminished of their power and they need to be replenished or something, and that's why they're in this semi-larval type state, whatever it is they're in. So again, this is another case of we don't know which way the power's going here, but as you mentioned, you know, the last time we saw Krona, he needed the entities, so...
Well, I have to give Anas credit for that too, because like I said, he and I were talking about it. So it did make sense also, because when you think about it, the way Predator just faded away, that kind of is reminiscent of Elise. I think that we know when leading up to War of the Green Lanterns, there were various ways in which Krona kind of was wrangling entities. So in a way, it makes sense. At least you get, there aren't many of these that have happened lately in Jeremy's book, so you give him credit for this, is that the reason, at least we understand to a certain extent, not that he showed it, other than what happened with Predator and seeing the corpse, we assume that the essence, the soul, if you will, of Parallax Jr. was taken, was pulled out before, but the fact that at least we know why the characters, even though they didn't show it, think all the entities are dead, even though it probably was just Krona pulling them out just like he did before to prevent them from being killed. Just like he was able to save Parallax after Hal and Parallax were separated again after defeating Black Lantern Spectre, when the real Spectre was about to go after Parallax and kill him, and Sinestro was all bent out of shape. And that's when Krona just kind of stepped in, oh, by the way, let me do this, and he just pulled him out, and it's like, we'll deal with this later, because that's not my story right now.
Yeah. I also, another thing I like here is power testing limits. Like, you know, it totally makes sense. Hey, you have shown the ability to regenerate this White Lantern thing. Let's test this. We got to figure out what our resources are, how long it can be maintained, and how long it takes to control it, and how long it takes to restore it. And not only what the on button is, but what the off button is, because she says, turn it off, turn it off. He says, I'm trying. And then it goes off. So, like, it absolutely makes sense. We have to know what our resources are at all times. So testing this limit makes sense. Why there's a limit still needs to be answered. Why it's so hard for him to access and control when he had such mastery over it before.
And is this stupid entity actually in him or not in him?
Yeah. So that all remains to be seen. But, you know, I still like it. It's logical. It's something, you know, like much in the same way I keep saying, like, or I've said for a little bit, we have to see the conversation between Aya and Razor at some point. We can't just reintroduce them and just let them be background characters and never have their moment. We need their moment at least before we put them into the background. I think the same thing needs to happen with Kyle. We need to explore this White Lantern thing. We can't just have him be our deus ex machina every single time. We need the White Lantern power to manifest itself. We gotta explore this a little bit, figure out the whys and the hows here. So we're starting down that path. I like that. Good. Another good thing, taking a bit of a page out of Geoff Johns's playbook, or, and not just Geoff, because did Robert do it? Like the whole, like, teasing things to come with, like, a Vision or something like that, or a flash to the future or whatever thing. It's not like it was ever pioneered by Geoff Johns. People have been doing this for a while. But in terms of recent Green Lantern times, I know we did it with Emerald Sight with Simon. We did it we kind of did it during Future State or whatever, because we saw the future. We also saw it, what was the other future story, Future's End.
Yes.
We got Future's End type, you know, a potential future the DC could head to. So we were kind of laying, you know, crumbs of, you know, for a little bit, you were kind of playing with the idea of something being told in the story. You're like, oh shit, this is the start of what we saw in Future's End. And then obviously Geoff did it a lot too and stuff like that. So now the content of these panels and how well this was executed, you know, we can talk about, but, you know, it's nice to kind of get a general Route 66 roadmap of where we're headed, just to sort of see these touch points and when they happen and what sequence and so on and so forth, something to look forward to. That's nice.
Plus, he gave us a similar vision where Hal was going to be going against the Guardians again. I just don't know if we ever actually got the payoff to that.
Yeah, we'll have to find that.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure that that he gave us something very, very similar, because I do want to talk about that.
We're already here. Let's talk.
So looking at that image, to me, there's like they're clearly implying that the Guardians are attacking Hal. So there's multiple ways to actually look at if we're trying to speculate what might actually be happening or what will happen when this comes to fruition. That number one, obviously. It may not really be Hal. It could be Krona ends up either he does find a way to heal the body, or he grows another body. So it's actually not Hal. It still could be Hal, but Hal could, but basically, because Hal's having these visions now, he could be going down the road of what happened with Kelly, where Krona basically is just going to take over Hal's body. So it actually is Hal's body being controlled by Krona. That's like another failsafe where, well, I saw, in case he's desperate, or even as a, you know, almost like a cyborg Superman doing the implant in the back of Doomsday's shoulder, in case of emergency, that's where I'm going next. It could be somehow the Guardians could be being controlled and Hal's fighting against them, or it might not even be what it looks like. The Guardians could be feeding Hal power because he's got to accomplish something. So it is interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, especially because the Guardians do they give you the typical cryptic Guardian crap in this issue. So that even though they like know almost nothing, but still it's like maybe you trust them, maybe you don't. It's like Guardians at this point. I don't think unless it's like Gansett, it's like you're probably never gonna really have a lot of trust level on any, and even Gansett, you know, he got mind control too. So at one point, so it's kind of hard to know, but that's the one. But I did like the image. It's, you know, it's pretty safe to say whatever going on with those stars has to do with it relates to probably the entities and the emotional spectrum. Or it could be foreshadowing something going on with the power batteries on Oa of the other cores. So it could be that. It logically makes sense because of the ties to Krona that we would think that it has to do with the entities and something that whatever Krona is going to be using them or needing them for.
Yeah, and the tower, we don't know. For some reason, my mind went into the issue with Zauriel and the Phantom Stranger, like this is some sort of gate or hell thing or something. I don't know. Looking back at that issue, I don't think that's the case, but that's the feel I get for it, the vibe. Also, just being a DC fan, you see a big, you know, unexplainable sort of tower, I think, of Crisis. You know, the towers that kept the multiverse sort of stable for a little bit during Crisis had a similar-esque-ish look, but those were always very Jack Kirby techy looking, and this looks more medieval, gothic, hellish, I don't know. So there's that. The Krona thing, the deformed Hal, that armor kind of looks like what Kilowog was wearing in Absolute 7. I don't think that is the case in terms of like they're trying to make a reference to it or something like that. It could be. I don't think so, but it's weird shape kind of reminds me of what Kilowog was wearing in that issue. But that's the most unlikely of everything I've said so far, just because I doubt they'd make that connection. At least this soon. We know at some point the Absolute Universe is going to crash into ours and it's going to be some summer event or some bullshit, but because that's just the way of things. But yeah. Another thing I like about this issue, and I'm just going to focus on some before I go into anything that, you know, not even a big negative. I don't have big negatives about this issue. But I like Hal's tour of the city. It shows that he's born here, raised here, spent a lot of time here, spent a lot of time saving the city, and obviously probably learned some stuff about the city and its history, one, from living it, and two, just from being, you know, it's one thing to be like, that's my hometown. It's another to be proud that it's your hometown. And having this much knowledge of the history of this, and he says, you know, this might be the best place on earth, my home, you know, like, you know, obviously, the guy who went batshit because his city was destroyed, it totally makes sense. But reinforcing it every now and then, especially with as many times as you just ditch him off into space and he doesn't come back to this touch point for fucking forever, which pisses me off. It's nice if even for a moment to, you know, characterize him as somebody who loves this town.
For the most part, I enjoyed that scene. I think this is another good Hal character, other than maybe when Hal's getting all mopey and sugary over Carol, which just seems, again, you can say it's maybe evolving Hal, and I guess that would be a fair analysis. It does still seem a little out of character for Hal, but other than that, potentially a little nitpick that the reality is. It's a good Hal characterization issue. So that's for Jeremy is at his best. It was interesting related to that too. The number one, it seems like an odd choice to have to mention the Presidio since we know that's in San Francisco. So I never really saw saw Coast City really as San Francisco, but maybe it's supposed to be their version of San Francisco. I didn't. I guess it kind of makes sense in a way, but it just seemed weird to take to name drop a real location that we know is in a real city and then put it in a fake city. So that was kind of odd. But the other thing this issue has a lot of is the fact that there's a Kaminsky building in Coast City. Hmm. And it's not like it's the name of the group editor or anything. So we know that's why it's in there. And maybe, like I said, when I said the quid pro quo, maybe that's why we get not one but two a little blurbs in this issue talking about the great Starbreaker supremacy and the other saga that he references, and it's like, okay, it's like this just reeks of quid pro quo.
Yeah. Hal, characterization-wise, also, I like these two moments. The first being in the med bay when Hal says, "I'll let you know if something comes up," and Guy immediately goes, "No, you won't. You're Hal Jordan. You're stoic enough. You'll stoic your way through whatever might happen." So they know, like, you know, you're not going to tell us because you never fucking tell us. And then the same thing happens. Well, similar same thing happens because he goes, "I'll handle the Star City thing," and then Carol immediately goes, "Hal, I know what happens when you go to Star City." So we don't have to deal with the whole, you know, Hal Jordan hiding things because he's, you know, brave and stoic, as they say. We don't have to deal with the whole Carol getting upset at him because he just was later than he intended to be because he got caught up with Ollie or whatever. So, like, I like that, like, everybody knows Hal Jordan, and we're not going to just take the easy way out to, you know, build tension between characters because people are pissed that Hal kept something a secret or Carol's mad at him because he was late for a date or some bullshit. You know, like, I like that we're like, you know what? We know Hal Jordan's Hal Jordan, and we're going to let Hal be Hal. But also, like, Jess and Guy are like, "We're still going to keep an eye on you, and I still insist you take a fucking break." So,
yeah, it was a good issue for Joe. I mean, it's a Freudian slip for Jessica. This was okay. As opposed to Joe, and it's like, it's almost like it's a checkbox thing. It's like every single issue, you have to have Joe say something about something that she knows, that she has, talk about something that she has no understanding and no history and no knowledge of, but she's going to talk like an expert on it. So now she talks about, "Oh, the Book of O, it survived this and it survived that." It's like, you don't know shit about the Book of O. You don't know what it's been through, what it's not been through. You're not the person to talk about it. It just gets annoying because that's like the only thing they ever have Joe do anymore is do stuff like that. So it just kind of makes her unlikable to me more and more because it's like, "Oh, yeah, let's have her talk about this and let's have her talk about that. Let's have her talk about the entities." It's like stuff she knows absolutely nothing about. Yeah. It's a minor nitpick, but it's just we get it all the time. It's like, it's just like you're kind of waiting for that shoe to drop every issue. It's like, "Oh, we have to have a requisite Joe sighting," which I don't know why we don't. I mean, we don't have Simon in this issue. We don't have Kelly in this issue. So why the hell do we have to have Joe do something and say something and kind of be snarky and getting on guys back about being a nerd and stuff like that? And it's like,
they're clearly building a relationship between these two.
Yeah, but what kind of relationship? I mean, if they end up hooking up, I would be okay with it. But I still think knowing the way...
Because Joe is canonically bi, right?
Or she... Yeah, but okay. I'm going down that road. But based on the way DC editorial is, I still think it's much more likely that they're probably going to have her hook up with Jessica than they will have her hook up with Guy. If they do have her hook up with Guy, then it's kind of this banter and this pairing up makes sense. But if it's another thing where, "Oh, you know, we're going to say she's bi, but we're really going to write her like she's gay, but then we can... Yeah, I don't know. We'll see if they go somewhere with this. I'm okay with the playful banter between the two of them. That's not a real big issue for me at all. It's just the fact that it just seems like maybe it's just a Jeremy thing. Maybe he doesn't really know how to write her, and she just comes across sometimes as just either being a know-it-all or arrogant or whatever. And it's just like, I mean, on the Green Lantern depth chart, I mean, she's friggin' behind Simon.
Well, it may be not just that Jeremy doesn't know how to write her. It just may be that his reference is what everybody else has already done with her, which is is made her the know-it-all. And I said this, so I can't remember. God, at some point it becomes less someone's fault for making her the know-it-all, and then somebody, the next creator, is just going to write her that way because that's how she was written previously. So we're never going to reset. We're just going to keep up appearances of what we've already done instead of someone circling back to the idea that she's not as tenured and shouldn't know these things and writing her as such, as opposed to just looking back at the previous arc from the previous writer and going, well, she was written this way. I will continue this.
Yeah, but this still is mostly Jeremy's fault because this is the most stuff we've got. This is the most stuff we've gotten from about Joe. I mean, if you want to blame Thorne a little bit, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, he was the first one to take her in after Jemison.
Yeah, I guess, but I don't...
Made her the leader of the Corps in that series. How is it not Thorne's fault?
I guess. I just don't remember her... I don't remember her speaking as much like she is in this book about always talking about a subject that she knows I mean, in a way, it made sense for her to take the lead a little bit because most of the Corps was pretty much wiped out for the most part. And her ring was different, and it was functioning differently. And they tried to play up the world's greatest detective garbage with her. So that part was annoying when they tried to, when they put her on the case of who the hell could have blown up the central power battery, that stuff. But still, I don't know. But either way, remember, comes back to the same thing. We don't know exactly what Jeremy could have wiped out from Thorne's continuity. So it's not necessarily an excuse, well, this is what Jeffrey Thorne did. You can dial stuff back, you know. You can, if somebody's a, it's like Simon. We don't like Simon, but Simon on the page is not nearly as douchey as he was in the Green Lanterns book, because we know that was a decision on purpose to make Jessica be more likable by default because the guy she's hanging around with isn't. But since then, Simon is not, the way he's written, we don't necessarily like him that much more, but he's not being written as abrasively as he was in that series where it was kind of hard to like him. So it's not really
an
excuse.
I'm writing him more like a big brother to now, which I liked him as a brother.
Yeah. So you can absolutely rein in some of this, or heaven forbid, have her make a mistake. Have her talk about something because she thinks she knows something, and then somebody points out, well, that's actually not entirely correct. Even if you think Thorne started the snowball going downhill, Jeremy's kind of like dialed it up to 11, I think, considering how little we get of Joe. Yeah. So it's, I think if he wanted to, he could dial it back.
But. Yeah. I would like to, like, a Green Lantern annual featuring Joe, where, like, everybody kind of, well, not everybody, because it's not like she's a super popular character, but the idea gets floated occasionally of, like, teaming her up with Batman because of the detective thing. I would actually like, and I know I'm biased here because I love Tim, I would like a Joe-Tim team up, Tim Drake, just because the way I see it, like, the Bat family, you know, Barbara is Batman's, more of Batman's intellect. Damian is more of his skill as a fighter. Jason is his rage and passion. Dick is like a good amalgam of everything that Batman is, but also like his sense of duty and justice is way more amplified, but he doesn't have the seriousness and the rage of Batman. Whereas Tim is the true detective among them, I think. So I would love to see Joe do a team up with Tim for some reason. I think Batman's too easy. I think if you're going to do a detective team up, it should be Joe and Dick, or Joe and Tim.
Yeah, but they stick with Bruce, you might show him up.
I got one more point before we end this. All right, the last thing I wanted to talk about just real quick was this was Guy Gardner's obsession with the Book of Oa. I get how some people could read that as weird or out of character, but I see it as potentially twofold. It's either A, the Book of Oa or Krona by extension or something to that effect is having an effect on Guy, because let's not forget, since, was it War Journal, he's had it in his closet in close proximity to him for a while. So it's possible it's polluting his mind, or even if it doesn't have, like, a nefarious intent. The Book of Oa not only contains history, but is often portrayed as having future knowledge. It's often portrayed in fiction what, you know, having access to such knowledge can do. You know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, sort of a thing. It could also be just that, just like us as people who have a very specific obsession with Green Lantern, my obsession didn't develop into my 20s. It's entirely possible at some point in your life to be exposed to something and all of a sudden just catch a rabid-like interest in it. And as we know, Guy loves the core and what it means to him. So to have the history of the core, it just became a passion and a study of his. So I see it as twofold. I don't necessarily agree with some of the comments I've seen online that it's weird to see Guy geeking out like this. I agree that it's potentially suspicious, but I don't think it's necessarily out of character. And even if it's a new character trait, I don't think it's out of line with what we know about Guy.
Well, in the story itself, he gives, whether you accept it on the surface or not, it is another story. But he gives you the explanation, because he makes it clear that generally speaking, he's a history buff. That's his thing. Now, again, we haven't seen much of it, so it's kind of like a retcon, arguably. But the point is that he's making it clear that, to him anyway, the obsession, if you will, or his complete dedication to exploring and understanding and just finding out everything that's hidden in this book that we didn't. So now that we know there's a whole multiple layers to this book than we ever thought that were there before, getting to getting, no pun intended, to the core of this mystery, that is being driven just because he's kind of like he's a history geek. He wouldn't phrase it that way, but that's. So, again, you may say it might be out of character, but in the story itself, they're giving you an explanation that this is just an extension of something that supposedly, from at least Guy's perspective, unless he's been made to think this, that from Guy's perspective, this is normal. That this really isn't anything out of the ordinary, that it could have been something else not related to the Book of Oa, but because it has to do with history, they kind of would have pumped his nads too. So, it's yeah.
Yeah. Totally forgot mentioning this earlier, by the way. I wanted to also mention, think it's weird that this particular Guardian is the only one who has a different colored bubble. I understand they all have different colored text and everything to match their emotion. And I also understand that it's possible that this particular Guardian has a yellow background with black font because it would be hard to be able to read a yellow font on a white background. So that's very likely all this is. But given that sometimes people speaking in different, like, colors or fonts or whatever is often a sign of something nefarious under the surface going on, it's worth pointing out that his bubble is the only one that's a different color.
It is something to note, especially because of the fact that he was the one who made the declaration, Hal Jordan knows, and then the other Guardian logically was our POV. It's like, what does Hal Jordan know?
Yeah.
What the hell are you talking about, man? So
for sure. But that's it. Pretty good issue, but again, we've seen, the occasional good issue, enjoyable issue from Jeremy before, so let's see how long it can keep going this time.
Yes, I agree.
All right, what's next?
So let's do sales, I suppose, which I luckily draw stumbled into. I kind of figured they were going to be coming out a little sooner because the last batch, the August numbers came out so damn late that it didn't surprise me that these numbers came out relatively close. So these are the September numbers, the September sale numbers. So going through the books that matter the most, not that there's many of them in September, Absolute Green Lantern number 6 was 24. Absolute Green Lantern 7, our favorite issue, down to 48. Green Lantern Corps number 8 was down to 130. That was a drop. and Green Lantern 27, which was... So, what Green Lantern Corps was, but 9 was the one that ended Starbreaker Supremacy?
I think so.
Yeah. So that we don't have that those sales numbers yet. But Green Lantern number 27, which would have been the second to last, the penultimate issue, that went that was 143, which technically is a rise because that was in the 150s the month before. So there's not a lot of dramatic shifting here. The only thing of interest to look at is that Absolute Green Lantern number 7 dropped all the way down to 48, which is the second worst selling issue that this book has had so far through its first 7. Now, it is again possible that just like the last time, there was a drop off. I think without looking at 53, right? I think without going back and looking, that I think number 4, absolute number 4 was 53. That one thing they have in common is that there were two issues, not counting resolicits, two new issues of Absolute Green Lantern have dropped twice. So you've had during this release cycle from a sales perspective, an ICV2 sales perspective. So it is possible that the only reason why Absolute number 4 dropped so much and Absolute number 7 dropped so much was just because there were two issues that came out that month. But we're not really going to know, again, if this means anything until we see the sales for Absolute Green Lantern 8 when it comes out, especially because even if you think this is story related, for the most part, you'd have to say Absolute Green Lantern 7, if the sales dropped to 48, it was because people didn't like 6, because you're not going to know you didn't like 7 until you already bought it, for the most part. So if Absolute Green Lantern 8 drops much, much lower than 48, then we probably can read into it and say, okay, based on what's actually in the book, now it's starting to lose some traction because people are kind of like checking out a little with the book. Yeah. Right now, it's plausible because 6 wasn't a great issue either. But we have to be objective and say, because of the commonality, that the only two times that we had Absolute Green Lantern books anywhere near the 50 ranking plateau, it was a double release month. So it is possible that's the only reason why it dropped down. But we won't know that until we obviously get the October sales and see. When does Absolute Green Lantern come out next?
I don't know. Don't care.
But it has to be November. It has to be November because we're already done. Because it didn't come out this week, right? Nothing.
Nothing came out this week.
Yeah. So the reality is, we're not gonna know until we get the November sales to see how this one sells. It's just a weird release schedule because obviously they have that. Is that sometimes there's some months when maybe one's not going to chart at all, that book, and then you have the month like this where two of them charted.
Yeah. All right. What else we got?
You said you wanted to talk a little bit about some of the Lantern news because it was funny because I was just watching didn't finish it, but I was watching the segment of John Campia's show talking about his discussion and their discussion as it was branching out. I think Robert Meyer Burnett was about to talk, which is usually much more interesting than John Campia anyway. But about the tidbits that we've gotten about the show, which I think is what Chad wants to talk about.
Aaron Pierre had a sort of spotlight article done on him by Men's Health. And in that, he talked about his breadth of work and stuff like that, and experience in the industry, including the upcoming Lanterns. I do want to start with just this brief thing. Just because we haven't talked about this MCU movie in a while. While Pierre was filming Rebel Ridge, he experienced his first public disappointment, or at least his most high-profile one, when it was announced that he'd been let go from Blade, a much-anticipated but troubled production that Flounders in development held to this day. I remember being cast in Blade and feeling elated, but something I learned during that time was that until you step foot on the set, you haven't commenced work, Pierre says. It just took a different creative direction, and I was no longer a part of it. You have to accept that. That's all he says. But, some news about Blade. It's been a while since we've had any.
That makes you and, like, 10 people happy, Chad.
Pierre will get another chance to add to a storied superhero legacy in HBO's Lanterns, and then it talks a bit about who's playing Lanterns and why Jon Stewart's a popular character and blah, blah, blah. Chris Mundy, the Lanterns showrunner, known for writing prestige crime thrillers like Ozark, Bloodline, and True Detective, says the series is a, quote, as much of a buddy cop show as a superhero show, unquote. And like any good buddy cop show, Hal and John are opposing forces. Quote, our show is in a lot of ways about replacement. When should someone step aside and when is it time for the next person to take the reins, unquote, Mundy says. Quote, that push and pull between those two characters is really important. So much of the power that John has is by not taking the bait, understanding that you lose your power if you're yelling and screaming. That's what we're trying to convey. He knows he belongs, so he doesn't have to overcompensate. There's a real balance there that's just innately inside of Aaron. He's big, he's an intimidating presence just physically, but there's a softness to him too. There's a thoughtfulness. You can't teach that, unquote. Jon Stewart is a revered comic figure, particularly to black readers. Quote, for me, the character just radiates strength and fortitude, unquote, Pierre says. Quote, that hunger to be the best version of yourself, which also holds you accountable when you're not, unquote. And on the off chance Pierre doesn't get hold himself accountable, comic fans will. That's the flip side of signing on to a beloved IP. You're not the only one who feels ownership of it. Quote, Aaron felt a responsibility, especially as a black man playing this particular role, to make sure he really understood him and brought him to life, Mundy says. I think fans will see the reverence he has for it, and that goes a long way, unquote. And then they went into the rest of some of his history, but that's the relevant part about Lanterns that is being sort of piecemeal quoted here and there throughout places like comicbook.com and stuff like that. But they're all referring to this Men's Health article, so I went back to the source.
I don't think this really surprises us. Most of
We all knew this was what it was, but this.
This is the reason why you, from an age perspective, regardless of what kind of good shape Kyle Chandler is in, and we know Myron will probably have a field day with this. That the reality is that's why you cast, quote unquote, you make Hal Jordan over the hill, because the whole point is that he's being pushed out, because you want Jon Stewart to be the main Green Lantern in the Gunverse. That's pretty crystal clear. We knew that from the mere fact that they kept, once we knew the casting and once we knew that the age discrepancy between the characters and plus Nathan Fillion being cast as Guy, it's clear that this is going to be a passing of the baton to Jon Stewart being the future and Hal and Guy being the past, and how you get there. Now, again, could it make for an interesting story, especially if they do it more along the lines of Lethal Weapon, where they're not constantly butting heads all the time, and yet there's an age discrepancy between the two, and one guy's kind of looking to retire, and maybe the other guy's not necessarily looking to push him out, as opposed to the opposite, where John may not just, Hal's the one who just keeps resisting and resisting. Is like, I don't want to go. And it's like, no, you should go. So it's a slippery slope. The idea of telling these stories where it's going to be in different time periods, which I like to think is going to be related to Hal too, not just John, because I think they can kind of confirm that we're going to see John in more than one. I mean, we know we're going to see John in more than one phase of his life anyway. So I'm hoping it applies to Hal too, but we don't know about that. Again, it's not anything horrible, but if you're trying to find something to cling to that make you believe that, oh, this isn't going to be like a one and done deal for Kyle Chandler, and that they're not just throwing the fans a bone and giving them Hal Jordan just to kind of brush them off the stage, whether they're going to parallax them down the road, or whether they just, you know, or whether, regardless of whether they're going to parallax them down the road or not, the fact is that he's going to be exiting stage left almost immediately as a Green Lantern. Once, you know, if we see him, he's going to be gone almost as quick, whether he's dead or not. Yeah, I don't think that makes it it doesn't change or ease your nervousness about that, because I think it's pretty safe to say that's what's going to happen here. In some way, shape, or form, he's going to be yesterday's news, because they're kind of making it sound like he already is.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, look, I understand and even agree with lots of the points of view about Kyle Chandler being too old, and lots of what Myron's points are about this, about like, okay, if you want to, you know, have more than one lantern or establish another lantern, you don't have to do so at the expense of Hal. You know, you can still tell the Hal stories and have him and tell his stories as well, and so on and so forth. But I also know that I am biased. I want all the Green Lanterns. I want all of them to be represented. I don't want anybody to be undercut. I want a Green Lantern. As much as I'm a DC fan, I also want a Green Lantern universe. I want a Green Lantern trilogy. I want to, you know, like the whole thing. So, but I know that you can't build the DCU on, you know, 60% Green Lantern and 40% the rest of it. So I have to understand that they may pick a POV lantern I would not prefer, but at the end of the day, I also want a faithfully done adaptation of whichever lantern they go with. Now, obviously, if they went with like Joe right off the bat or something, everybody should be pissed. Rightfully so. I like, you know, regardless, like even... I could even understand somebody being pissed if they started with Kyle right off the bat, though if they made it very clear that this was like a super already in progress DC universe, we're talking 10, 15, 20 years down the line, we're already within this universe, I could understand starting with somebody like Kyle. You know, like Kyle instead of Hal and Wally instead of Barry and like that sort of a thing. Just starting with that, what was that, Grant Morrison's JLA, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah, like that era of DC, I could get that, but like I don't hate John, I don't dislike John, I just would prefer Hal, as would clearly Myron and other people. It's just, I don't know, we've seen three projects in the DCU: Creature Commando, Superman, and Peacemaker, right?
That I believe is correct.
So this is our fourth project. So with Superman and Peacemaker being the only two live-action ones, do we fully have a sense of this universe yet? I don't know. Maybe this will help build the sense of this feel that this universe is going for. Maybe Jon Stewart makes more sense in what they're doing universe-wide than Hal does. We don't know. There's just so much we don't know that I can't get fully behind where Myron's at in terms of like, just he's not even going to see the show. He's not going to watch it. But I also understand Myron's love of Hal is much deeper than anything else that this is disrespect in Myron's eyes. And I completely understand why. So I can't fault him for not wanting to see it. So but I use Myron as a placeholder for almost anybody who's, you know, railing against the show or saying that they're pissed at it or not going to watch it for A, B, C, or D. I think that may be unfair in lots of ways, because Myron has a very legitimate reason for it, whereas some other people are just doing it for, you know, Well, Hal's my favorite guy, and unless he's featured, I don't care. But they don't have that, seemingly don't have that deep, deep connection to Hal. It's just he's their favorite, and everybody else is stupid. I think there's just too much that remains to be seen for me to completely abandon the idea that we should have 100% gone with Hal. I do agree that you can do both, but is there a way to cleanly do so in what's being built? We don't know. We don't know if Hal's a better fit. We don't know if John's a better fit. We don't know A, B, C, or D. And until we see it, I'm just going to hold out hope, because I do like what we're saying here about He knows he belongs. He doesn't have to overcompensate. He understands that you lose your power if you're yelling and screaming, because that's what we saw in the development of Jon Stewart as a character. He was the angry young black architect in the 70s, and he was a civil rights leader or participated in lots of civil rights stuff at the very least. Around the time he was introduced, he was loud. He was boisterous. He was, you know, fuck authority and so on and so forth. But as Stewart developed over the years, especially once we got him into the whole idea that he was in the military and so on and so forth, ironically, we talked about the word stoic this episode. The stoic, the calm, the tactician, the fighter, the soldier, Jon Stewart, really settled in. The quiet, powerful presence that of Jon Stewart when he's not being overly emotional or whatever. So I like that. What we're sounds. Does it confirm everything we've thought about what they're doing to Hal? Sure. But it also doesn't define John in such a way that I'm saying they're not doing John justice either.
That would be obviously the worst case scenario, where you kind of shaft and Hal, and in the process you're not doing John Stewart any favors either, even though you can make a case, depending how you shaft Hal, even if you do a good interpretation of John, it still kind of puts extra baggage on that character from that he probably doesn't need. But we'll see. We know, for better or for worse, we know James Gunn is more of a JLU guy, and this is, so it kind of was inevitable, I think, we were going to get. Once we started getting, you know, the plan, you know, once you started hearing stuff, and we know, obviously, like we said, once you did the casting, you can, you know, that writing was way, way, way on the wall. Like you said, it could be worse. It could have been friggin' Simon. It could have been Joe, which, in a way, that wouldn't have surprised me at all. Let's put it this way. If we're going to get a second newish Green Lantern to either be Jon Stewart's sector partner, or just to have another younger Green Lantern, because they're going to get rid of Guy at some point, that it would be stunning if it's not either Jessica or Joe. I mean, in fact, I would bet everything that it's going to be. I think, in a way, Kyle's more of a dirty word, I think, probably. I don't know if he's a big Kyle guy. I kind of don't think that he is. But
well, don't forget, My Adventures with Green Lantern is Jessica and Kyle.
Yeah, but we don't know if Kyle's green, right? We just know that he's in it.
Yeah, we just know Kyle's in it. But yeah, also combine that with the fact that we've been told that whoever is playing these characters in live action or animation is going to remain consistent. We have Jessica cast.
Yeah.
So
it does greatly imply that we will see Jessica. It'll be easy enough to see Jessica again because we know we're going to see her, period. I'd like to bet on Jessica more. You have to be somewhat nervous, because obviously it seems like Joe is kind of like editorials, this current regime's character they want to push. So and because of her sexuality, she checks one more box than Jessica Cruz does. Unless you want to throw in the PTSD thing and the mental illness aspect of it, and then I guess Jessica has that checkbox and Joe doesn't. So it depends on what checkboxes are most important at a given time. I would like it to be. I can understand it more if it is Jessica. But we'll see. I mean, we have to see how it makes me a tad nervous about how they're going to portray Hal too. Because if they go with this yelling and screaming stuff, making it sound like, well, John kind of almost has to resist giving into that, that makes it sound like, well, even though it may not necessarily be pointing all those fingers that it's going to be Hal that's the one that's going to be trying to get that reaction out of him, it kind of implies it to me that, in a way, Hal's going to be kind of like antagonistic towards him, or belligerent towards him. So if they don't, so they could completely butcher Hal Jordan's character or make him much more of a dick, kind of going to what we talked about earlier tonight, like going the Lantern's route of making Jon Stewart look better because you're making Hal Jordan look worse in the same process. So then you would have a double whammy. You could be off in this character, and, you know, in his first real appearance, those whatever number of episodes we have of the show, you could be offing him right away and also have him be a jerk when he's around. So A, people who don't know Hal Jordan and love him might not, probably wouldn't miss him. And it makes Jon look like the more such a nice, rational, calm, non-stereotypical black man, you know, quote-unquote, because of how things get labeled at times, and like you talked about, his origin as the angry black man, that just having contrast that, you know, he's even-keeled, non-emotional, logical, intelligent, and have Hal be just, you know, almost act like Guy in a way. They could do something like that. That would not be cool.
No, I think that if they go the route of yelling angry Hal Jordan, I have a feeling they'll go like, you know, him railing against the idea of retiring. He's not wanting to quit. He's not wanting to be replaced. I hope they don't do it like they did in when John was first introduced, where they made it seem, at least for a second, like Hal was racist. Remember when they were like, yep, you're not interested, yep, in your petty bigotries or whatever it is he said? And Hal's like, that's not what I meant. So even in the issue where they brought the concept of Hal being that way, when it came up, they made sure to squash that. But it was very clear that Hal was sort of resentful at the idea, and not even necessarily the idea of being replaced, because at the time it was about finding another sector partner. And because Guy was incapacitated and you needed a backup, he was more railing against the idea, I think, of how John went about things. Like, he wasn't doing it the way Hal did it. And Hal didn't like that because, like, well, just, I mean, on the face value, not wearing a mask is one of the very first things, if not the very first thing John does. And Hal didn't like that. So maybe it's either A, I would accept in character the idea of Hal not wanting to be pushed out and retired, not ready for retirement or whatever. I would also accept the idea that Hal's a little bit stubborn and not really accepting of there's another way to do this.
There are positives here. I mean, well, positives might be strong. There are ways to get the point across in a less confrontational or antagonistic fashion, so we're gonna have to see how it's handled. So that, and but again, as a Hal guy, it certainly gives me much greater pause. I'm looking forward to the show, but I have much greater pause than certainly if I knew Hal was going to be the main character, or if you didn't keep hearing these things, which kind of make it clear that, yeah, you know, Hal Jordan's on his way out the door. And he's probably going to be out the door by the time the series ends. If he's still alive, either way, he's probably not going to be, you know, he's going to be pushed into retirement, whether he wants to or not. So, yeah.
Well, you also keep hearing about the chemistry that Kyle Chandler and Aaron Pierre have. So I do hope that if they are butting heads for a little bit at first, that it's only just at first.
Yeah.
Because I would love to see kind of like that moment we got at the end of the Starbreaker War, where they were coming out of the diner and they're just ribbing each other. Like, I want some of that, and I want more of that than the antagonist between the two of them on display. I want to see more of them as, you know, pals, basically. And I think that's kind of what I've been enjoying about James Gunn's universe so far. At least, obviously, I haven't seen Peacemaker and stuff, so I guess I'm really just referring to Superman, is this idea of it doesn't all have to be dark and gloomy and antagonistic and stuff like that. Because I actually just refinished a rewatch of Arrow. I was going to start rewatching the Arrowverse as a whole, so I wanted to just do show by show. And one thing I really realized that the opportunity we missed in Arrow, in going what it was, going after what it was, the tone that it had, and also maybe the availability of the individual actors, is we established Roy Harper, and we established Thea. So we established these, you know, these Red Arrows, these Speedies, but they were only ever around for a little bit before somebody else came in, or before Arrow got all, I shouldn't have a team, the mission is about me, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. The whole dark broodiness of Ollie's life, that, you know, the Batman-esque of it all that it somehow took on for some reason. And we missed cheerful Ollie, you know, and we saw loving brother Ollie in his moments between Ollie and Thea as Ollie and Thea, but we never got to see him having fun with Roy and them joking around. And when it was only these brief appearances, these brief windows, these small arcs before something else very serious happened when we took the focus away from these characters, or the characters took a hiatus from a show as the actor, and we missed the opportunity. And that's some of what grabbed people, and they're like, I prefer Flash. When Flash started, not how much it ended, but when Flash started, it was more the levity of the side, and we didn't get that with Arrow, so we missed that opportunity to see those relationships between Ollie and his sister, or Ollie and Roy. And that's what I want to see in Lanterns and other projects moving forward, is these friendships established, and the fact that these can be friendships, and we don't have to, you know, the standard superhero meets a new superhero and we don't trust him yet, so he must be a threat, so we got to have our fight before we become friends thing bullshit. I understand the innate pushback and resistance Hal could or would had to the idea of being replaced or whatever, but I hope we don't focus on it.
I agree. I agree that's not going to be where the whole thing is about. He doesn't want to be taken kicking and screaming.
Yeah.
Now, just like I mentioned, we don't want it to be where he keeps resisting to be taken away. And John's like, yeah, I think it's time you pack it in. It's like, you've had your day. It's like, I think it should be.
Get out of here, old man.
Yeah. Get off my lawn.
What's the cartoon? How many times do we have to teach you this lesson, old man? It's like Simpsons or Family Guy or something. They had like a popular bit about that. Anyways. All right. Anything else? Are we done?
I think we're done for today.
All right. If people want to reach out to us, what do they do?
LanternCast.com. The email is lanterncast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter. Like us on Facebook. Hashtag GLcast to track us down. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean. Wherever you listen to us on, please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708 Lantern, and let us know what you think.
All right, everybody. Good night.
Good night.